What I'd like to do this evening is really return to a question that we asked in our first class, and we've answered in part, and tonight I'd like to answer it more fully. And that is really the $64,000 question. Can put it in a couple of ways. One is, what makes Rashi Rashi? What makes Rashi so special? Or to put it a little differently, why has Rashi survived and thrived for the last 900 years? And why has he achieved so much remarkability and popularity, so much more really than any other commentator in the history of commentaries on the Bible and on the Talmud? So this is the question that I would like to answer tonight, and I'd like to suggest, again, there are many answers to this question. I would like to argue that it's a combination of five factors, that there are really five sub answers to this question. So part of what we'll see tonight is intended to be a little bit of a review, because it'll touch on some of the themes that we've talked about in the past few weeks, and some of what we'll see tonight will really be entirely new. To begin, I'd like to suggest that the first reason why Rashi is so popular and so remarkable is simply a function of his ability to be concise and eminently readable. Which is to say, he takes the hard work out of the project of reading and interpreting the text of the Torah. We've talked about this a little bit, and even in either the first or second week, we saw an example of this. Let me just, and again, just to back this up, give you one example. Without harping on this too much, because I think it's fairly self-evident. When you look at Rashi and you understand just how brief and how much he's able to squeeze into a short amount of space. Have a look at source number one. A famous pasuk and a famous commentary, famous Rashi. The Torah says, we all know, Vahi riv bein ro'eh mikneh Avram, u'bein ro'eh mikneh lot, v'akneni v'aprizi, az yoshev ba'aretz. Because there's a lot to say about this pasuk. This pasuk is from really the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, where the shepherds of Avraham and Lot are feuding, and in the end, this is what causes Avraham and Lot to go their separate ways. So the pasuk at face value says the shepherds of Avraham and the shepherds of Lot were having some kind of quarrel, and then part two of the pasuk, which seems to be almost a non sequitur, v'haktani v'haprisi az yoshev ba'aretz, and the Canaanites and the Perizzites were then dwelling in the land. We saw a similar question and a similar Rashi once before, where the pasuk had said v'haktani az ba'aretz, and we asked a similar question, which is, who cares, right? Obviously the Canaanites are in the land. Now the Torah is going out of its way to repeat that and to add that the Perizzites are in the land. Who cares about that second half of the pasuk? So have a look at source number two. There's a very lengthy medrash on this pasuk. The medrash says, let me explain to you what is going on behind the scenes. He read Ben Ro'eh Mikneh Avram in source number two, Ben Ro'eh Mikneh Lot. There was this quarrel, there was this strife. Rabbi Barachia b'shem Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Simon Amar behemtosh Avraham Avinu Haisa Yotza Zemuma. You know, the animal of Avraham, or the animals of Avraham, used to go out muzzled. Behemtosh Lot Lo Haisa Yotza Zemuma. But the animals of Lot used to go out unmuzzled. Hayu Omrim Lehem Rei Avraham. And the shepherds of Avraham used to say to the shepherds of Lot, Hutar HaGezel, are you allowing your owner to, in effect, steal? Right? If you're allowing your master's sheep to pasture in the fields of other people unmuzzled, then in essence you are stealing from those other field owners. Hayu Omrim Lehem Rei Lot. Now this is meaning we know that part, right? That we all learned in second grade. But now I don't know if we learned the second half of the medrash. The shepherds of Lot answer back. And they say, "Oh, we actually thought this one through. Let me tell you what. Let me tell you our thinking." Hayu Omrim Lehem Rei Lot, Kacham Arkadosh Baruch Hu Avraham. You know, there was a promise that Hashem made to Avraham just a few psukim earlier. With Zaracha Tenes Haaretz Hazos, to your progeny, I promise the land. The Avraham. Parda Akara, the Enamali, Does Abraham have any kids? The shepherds of Lot say. This is before Yitzchak and Yishmael are born. Does he have any children? He's childless. L'machar humeis. At some point in the future, literally tomorrow, he's bound to die. V'lot ben achiv yosho. Who stands to inherit the promised land, right? Literally the land promised to Abraham. Naturally, the next in line is Lot, Abraham's nephew. Bein ochlin miditun, the in ochlin miditun ain't an ochlin. We're eating of the field which ultimately actually belonged to us. Well, it didn't happen yet, but we're the ones, right? We're the shepherds of Lot. Lot is essentially the heir to Abraham. Abraham was promised this land. You do the Talmudic math, this land belongs to us. Amar lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kach amarti lo lezaracha natati. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so he says back to them, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, lezaracha natati. Hey Matai, when is it going to be promised to your descendants? L'kshiyakru shiva amami mitocha. Only after the seven nations have been banished from the land and the descendants of Abraham, the Jewish people, take possession of it. Now the Medrash says, I'll explain to you the second half of the Pasuk. What's the relevance of the fact that the Canaanites and the Perizzites are in the land? Right? Until now, they're the ones in possession of this land. The ownership hasn't changed yet. So you, the shepherds of Lot, are operating on a false premise. You believe that this land will one day be your entitlement, and therefore you sort of have surmised that you now have permission to go ahead and graze unmuzzled sheep on this pasture land. In fact, it's not true. The Torah is telling you it hasn't happened yet. That's a promise for the future. The present is that this land belongs to the Canaanites and the Perizzites. You, in fact, are violators of Gezer. That's the Medrash. How long did it take the Medrash to say that? I don't know, 5, 6 lines? That was a mouthful. No pun intended. Rashi, in source number 3, he says the whole thing in 2 lines. What was the reed? Bahi reed, there was some quarrel. Bishayu roim shalot v'shayim. He adds the editorial comment. The shepherds of Lot were wicked. Umarim behemtam besadus acherim. And they used to pasture their sheep and others in fields belonging to other people. Abraham, and Abraham's shepherd, Mochichim Osam al Gezel, used to chastise them about Gezel. Again, a little bit of an editorial comment, not in an accusatory way, but they used to try to promote a good value of, oh, shouldn't you guys be thinking about how not to steal? The Hamar Mim, no, and now he tells you the internal logic of the shepherds of Lot, which the Medrash spelled out at length. Hamar Mim Nasna Aretz La Abraham. It's amazing. We couldn't say it any more succinctly than Rashi does it. They said back, the land is promised to Abraham, below Ein Yoresh, period. He has no heir. Below Yosho, Lot is bound to be the heir. Ein Zeh Gezel. Do the math, it's not Gezel, it's not thievery. A Kasuv Omer, and therefore the Pasuk ends by telling you, below Zacha Ba Abraham Adayin, the Canaanites and the Perizzites are still in the land, the promise has not yet been fulfilled. How much did Rashi add? Not that much. The beauty of Rashi in this comment is that he took a lengthy medrash and made it succinct almost into 2 or 3 little sound bites, which you could repeat, right? The shepherds are the shepherds of Lot are the bad guys. The shepherds of Lot are the good guys. They had a mistaken logic about the inheritance of the land, and that is the meaning of Akhnei Vahprisi Azir Shevar. Everything fits, and Rashi manages to say it in a couple dozen words rather than in 6 lines. I don't want to harp on this because we've talked about it before. I think it's a self-evident point. Doesn't require that much more backing, which is to say that part of the beauty of Rashi is that he's able to be so succinct and able to consolidate so much information into such a short amount of a commentary that this has, at least in my opinion, contributed to the staying power of Rashi. It's so easy, it's so readable, it's so succinct and concise that it just says, read me. You know, and I think it's especially easy for us to understand. In 2007, we place such a high value on, you know, the Give me the executive summary. Give me the soundbite. I don't have time to read the whole article. Give me the headlines. Just fill me in quickly. And Rashi is able to do exactly that. Any lingering comments or points about what I would call point number one, which is that Rashi's staying power owes in large part to his ability to consolidate complicated and lengthy sources and make them succinct and easily readable. So that's a great question. The Medrash, the truth of the matter is, Midrashim were written and collected as early as the Tannaitic period, which is the first century of the Common Era, and really continued even during and past the lifetime of Rashi into, let's say, the latest Midrashim, the Yalkut Shimoni, is like 13th, 14th century. So Rashi is working with a whole slew of Midrashim, probably primarily from, let's say, the year 100 to the year 500, with some even later than that. Rabbi Straffler, would you say that's an accurate time frame, more or less? Okay.
When were they codified?
Well, the Midrashim were never codified in the sense that there's no authoritative code of Medrash. They exist in anthologies. And part of, as we've been discussing, part of the beauty of Rashi is that he has access to this huge corpus of Midrashic literature, and he helps us, who has the time, who has the energy, who has the ability. On every pasuk there could be 10 Midrashim, so Rashi gives you, here's one, and not just one, but the best pieces of the best one, or the most relevant one, or the most important one. Yes, Sylvia.
How did he? Mass. I mean, this is something that's.
Yeah. So that's a good question. Meaning, it's not so different from saying, how did we get all these books in our fourth floor base medrash? It's the 11th century. They don't exist in book form. They exist in manuscripts. And what's that? Yeah, yes and no, meaning he was born 50 years before the beginning of the Crusades, so for the better part of his lifetime the Jews were doing okay in the sense that they weren't running for fear of life and limb, and he was able to establish Beit Medrash and establish schools and students, and he was the greatest sage of his generation. He was appreciated as much in his own lifetime, so it was no wonder that if someone had access to a manuscript, it would be if anyone would have access to it, it would be Rashi.
Translation: Zemuma. I didn't get that. Zemuma.
Muzzled.
Muzzled.
Yeah.
Okay, another question. Hanani Od
Ba'aretz. Yeah.
Couldn't that present some kind of a chronological problem, an anachronism of some kind? I think I read somewhere something about that. Hanani Od Ba'aretz.
Well, no. If anything, it actually fits very beautifully. The land is called Canaan at that moment, yeah. because the Canaanites are in the land. So from a historic, let's say, within the own internal history of the Bible, it makes perfect sense. Okay, last question on this point, then I want to move forward.
What does it mean to be concise? It means that he understands the ideas better than someone who is verbose?
So I think that's a good question, and we could talk more about it. What I mean when I say that Rashi is concise is really two points. One is to say, yes, that he's really able to get to the core and the crux of the central ideas of the Medrash. And then the second point is that he's able to convert that, to sort of translate it into these sound bites, which are so easily digestible, meaning I could understand the theme of a particular book very, very well, but it could take me 4 days to explain it to you, whereas Rashi could do it in 4 seconds. So I think it's really both. It's a deeper and more intuitive understanding of the central message of the Medrash, and the ability to communicate that in really the most, succinct means possible. Does that answer your question? Okay. The second argument that I would like to make And this we've also talked about. We've also talked about at various points over the course of the semester. And again, if you walked in late, the central question that I want to address tonight is: what gives Rashi so much staying power? Why has he become and remained the central and most prominent commentary in the history of commentaries on the Bible in the last 1,000 years? Point number one was his ability to be ultimately readable and concise. And point number two, I'd like to suggest is his moral relevance, his capacity to communicate, let's say, educational and ethical ideas to a readership in a very relevant kind of way. So again, we've spent time talking about this, and we've even suggested that at times Rashi will choose an interpretation which sometimes isn't the best fit for the text, but does something to help us better understand the moral or the value, the message that the Torah is attempting to communicate. So again, without harping on this point, because we've spent some time on this already, have a look at source number four. Source number four is talking about a specific purification process that would go on in the temple, which I don't want to get into the details. Just very briefly, the Torah says, "V'lakacha kohen." Part of the process would be that the kohen would take eitz erez ve'ezov, u'shni solas v'ishlicha tov srefas ha'apara. So you take the wood of erez and ezov. What's erez?
Cedar.
And ezov. Ezov.
Hyssop,
excellent, right? And then the Shni Solas. What's Tolas?
Worm?
No, not worm. Not worm. Shni Tolas is dyed wool, right? The Shlichal Tov Shrifat Ha'Parah, and he would then send it into the fire that was burning, into the ashes of the cow. Okay. Without getting too far afield, what's the relevance of the eitz, erez, and ezov? The erez and the ezov, the cedar and the hyssop. Again, someone had sinned and now they're being purified. What's the relevance of those two particular woods? So Rashi, very briefly in source number five, says, you know, I just want to point out to you, the erez hu agavoa mikola ilanos. Cedar happens to be the biggest tree. Okay, you know, certainly in that region, cedars of Lebanon, those are always considered to be the biggest, the tallest, the strongest, that's the best, that's the biggest and the best wood, right? That's the biggest. The ezov, mimuch mikulam. And hyssop is the, you know, hyssop is this little bush, nothing of a tree. It's the lowest of the low. What's the relevance of that? Siman shagavoa shnizka'e v'chata. So what's the relevance of the lowest and the highest? It's a kind of metaphor, because the person who sinned had become too high and mighty and too haughty, and that was what led him to sin. He now lowers himself and becomes the lowest of the low, the hyssop, the nothing of the nothing, and that affects the process of redemption and tshuva. The pasuk makes perfect sense without this Rashi. You don't need this Rashi. This Rashi is not coming to explain the simple meaning of the verse, as we talked about at length last week, to make the argument that this Rashi is necessary to understand only the basic, you know, level reading of this pasuk. That's a hard case. That's a hard case to make. What I think is an easier case to make is that Rashi sees an important moral message that can be extracted from this text, and he uses a couple of hints in the text as a springboard to communicate that important message. Excuse me. Questions about this source or this notion?
Where is the text where does it say how the mighty flow from? In other words, the mighty tree.
Yeah, meaning Rashi, you know, for the most part is not inventing or creating the sources or the ideas. He is rather the extractor and the kind of gatherer. And he'll help us understand what might be a very important moral message that we might not otherwise come to on our own or think would be relevant to this particular point or to this particular text. What I'd like to argue is that part of what makes Rashi so compelling is that he's able to speak in a language which makes kind of a moral sense and has kind of a moral resonance with his readership. We can all, right, you put yourself in the mind of Rashi, you can all relate to the notion of, oh, we got carried away and that's really what, you know, we thought too much of ourselves and that's what caused us, or that's what caused somebody else to go down that road. We sort of understand to come back and to lower ourselves is going to be part of the process of expiation. A thousand years after Rashi gets written this, it still makes perfect ethical sense.
Does he ever change his commentary totally to the original? In other words, put his own interpretation in it that would be totally different than the original? Yeah, occasionally.
Meaning more often than not, Rashi is adding only very subtle messages and subtle points. Sometimes he will say, you know, this is the explanation that's been pretty standard or presented by the past generations of commentaries. I would suggest something as an alternative. That does happen on occasion. Okay, other points. And again, I don't want to spend too much time or produce too much evidence. A great sermonizer, right? The best sermonizer, and we've seen these we've seen examples of this over the course of the semester. So I consider this a kind of headline review rather than a fresh thought. Okay. Other questions or lingering thoughts about that, Alan?
Anybody else that wrote around the same time like Rashi that did similar, like he did, like maybe Sadi Ron?
Well, meaning there are contemporaries and there are commentaries, you know, immediately before and immediately after. What's that?
I mean, like, wouldn't have other people looked at other interpretations also, like,
yeah.
Later on, I know, like, Ibn Ezra.
Sure.
Like, he wrote different
No commentary in the history of any commentary ever gained as much popularity so fast and for so long as Rashi. There are other popular commentaries. Just to throw out a statistic, which we threw at toward the beginning of the semester, a commentary means a commentary on a primary text. A super commentary is a technical word for a commentary on a commentary. So you know how many commentaries there are on Rashi? You know how many commentaries have been written on, just to understand Rashi, in the past 1,000 years? Over 250. Okay? That number is mind-boggling. Can you name anyone who wrote a commentary on Ibn Ezra? There are a couple. Can you name anyone who wrote a commentary on the Rashbam? There's one or two. 250, I mean, it blows everything else out of the water. Just to give you a sense of the disproportionality of Rashi's importance and Rashi's popularity. Okay.
How did it enter the Sephardic tradition?
So, that's a good question, and it's more of a, you need more of a historian than me to answer that question. But the short answer is that it was so good and so compelling that almost immediately, even in the Sephardic tradition, there was a kind of immediate acceptance in that world. And again, hopefully by the end of this hour, you know, with the first two answers and with the following three, we'll have some better sense of why that was so. But it's really the same question of how did it become so popular so fast. You know, and why did it gain so much traction, even in a community where Rashi was so foreign and so distant?
Well, Rambam was a Sephardic Jew.
Right, that's just the best case in point. Rambam was the greatest Sephardic sage of his generation. And he starts virtually every conversation and every discussion with a quotation of Rashi. Before I can offer anything of my own, I'll contend with Rashi and I'll dispute Rashi's interpretation. But even Ramban, who was living just a generation after Rashi, already by that time, it was known that before you can even say anything, you have to, you know, deal with Rashi's interpretation of the text. Okay. What I'd like to suggest is the third reason why Rashi has become and remains so popular. is that Rashi has a unique capacity to bring the text to life. There are some moments in the text, there are some times in the text where, as a reader, just reading the text in a kind of simple or superficial way, we get stuck, or we get bored, or we get a little alienated, or a little disillusioned, or a little lost. And Rashi has this amazing ability to help us, the simple readers of the text, to keep the text hot, to keep the text interesting, to keep the text moving and compelling. And he's able to do this by employing both pshat and drash, and knowing when each is more valuable. Okay, just have a look for a moment at, let's say, very famously, source number 8 and 9. I chose the next couple sources actually because they are from our parsha. Okay, you could choose a million sources, but these are coming up. The pasuk says, right, the brothers threw Yosef into a pit. V'habor reik ein bo mayim. The pit was empty, there was no water in it. Okay, so as a normal, rational reader of this text, you got to ask the obvious question of that's redundant. Obviously, if it's empty, there's no water in it. So, as an average reader, just someone cruising through this text, I'm a little stuck. Why did the text do that? So Rashi comes along and helps us out. V'habor reik ein bo mayim, source number 9. Mimashma shenemar v'habor reik, from the fact that the Torah told us that it was empty, ein yodeh she'ein bo mayim, wouldn't I know that there's no water in it? Ma'al Talmud Lomer ein bo mayim, what's the Torah adding by telling us that there was no water? Mayim ein bo, there was no water in the pit, aval nechashim v'akravim yeshbo, but there were scorpions and snakes in the pit. Just added a whole other color, level of color, a whole other dimension to the text. If you're the average reader of the text, the brothers threw Joseph into an empty pit, and there was no water. So we're dealing only with the absence, which creates the problem. So you picture, it's a good story, right? It's a compelling story. You don't need a lot of color to keep the story hopping right along. It's a compelling narrative, but there's still only kind of that many layers. So Yosef has this problem. He's now in this pit, and there's no water. Rashi comes along and says, it wasn't just that there was a pit, but it was actually a situation of danger right then and there. Now there's snakes, now there's scorpions, now there's clear and present danger to the life and limb of Yosef. Wow, the story is really coming alive. Or take one other brief example from the same narrative, just a few psukim later. The Torah says, Vayeshev Ruvain el Habor, in source number 10, the bottom page 1. Ruvain returned to the pit. Vine ein Yosef Habor. Yosef wasn't there. He kareyes begadav, and he tears his clothing.
Vayeshev, is it really Vayeshev?
I'm sorry, no, you're right. Vayashav. Vayashav. Thank you for correcting me. Ruvain returns to the pit. Yosef's not there. If you've been following the text, you got to ask the question, where'd he go? He's returning? From where? I thought everyone was together, and there was a whole plot, the 10 brothers, and they get him, and they take his coat off, and they throw him into that. Yeah, so, no, but Reuben was there at the original discussion, because Reuben is, just a few seconds later, Reuben is lobbying for a different plan. No, we shouldn't kill him, but... So where'd he go? 1 minute he's there, 1 minute he's not. Source number 11, Rashi says, oh, I'll tell you where he went. Hayashav Ruvain, uvim mechira solo hayasham, yeah. He actually wasn't there when they sold him. He wasn't in it. Shehigia yomo leilech uleshamesh es aviv. There was some kind of rotation. And while all the shepherds were out in the field, someone had to be back at home with Yaakov, with the, let's say, elderly father. Why wasn't Yosef with the brothers in the first place, right? So Rashi's alluding to the fact, oh, it must have been his turn. Now there's a rotation, Yosef goes out to the field, and Reuven comes home, and they have this whole rotation, or Davarchar, alternatively. Asukaya b'sako v'taniso al shabil b'l yatsu aviv. Or, maybe he was donning sackcloth and mourning over the fact that he was about to bring so much grief to his father. But either way, Rashi adds a whole other dimension to the text which we would never have been privy to. Right? We have this whole other layer of narrative where Rashi does us this great service of filling in the gaps and keeping the narrative alive. Just very briefly, have a look with me at source number 12, Avram Grossman. Okay. It's a similar related point. Yes, Esther.
Where did he know that from?
Okay, so that's a great question. So one is, so I actually didn't look up the source. I'm sure, though, even without having looked up, it's a midrashic. It's a midrashic tradition. Rashi's not making it up, and maybe there's some allusion in the pasuk which he's leaving out a word here or a kind of hint there. But meaning he didn't make this from whole cloth. He's just extracting it from an existing midrashic tradition.
And within that Rashi that he originated, where he got it from?
Typically,
a lot of attribution.
Yeah. No, it's 50-50. And I still don't have a great answer to that question. Sometimes Rashi does. He'll quote a source. He'll quote a source or he'll quote a name, you know, as we saw earlier actually, and if you go back to it's interesting, go back to source number 2 versus source number 3, right? In the original Medrash, there was attribution, lots of attribution. It was Rabbi Barachia, I'm in source number 2 in the top line, it was Rabbi Barachia in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Bar Simon. And Rashi left it out, right? Maybe because we don't know who those people are anyway. Right, it's not Rabbi Akiva, you know, it's not Rabbi Elazar, or maybe Rashi had a different text where he didn't have the attribute. You know, I don't have a great answer to that question. Ira?
This Rashi also is an example of teaching us ethical lessons, because even when the brothers are plotting the demise of their brother, they're sensitive enough to their old father to be rotating who's taking care of them.
That is a great point. You know, I hadn't even thought of that, which is that, you know, it's almost so ingrained in Rashi's subconscious that almost without even thinking about it, or I certainly, you know, would have or could have missed it, there's almost always, you know, if you unpack it, there's almost always some kind of ethical message being delivered in addition, right, as we talked about the multiple valences of the text, one of which is to make the text more readable, the other is to deliver this ethical punch. And I think you're right, it's a beautiful ethical lesson. I hadn't thought of it. That's a whole sermon right there. Even when you're plotting to sell your brother into slavery, right, and you're worried about grieving, we're still going to keep up the rotation to make sure, you know, that someone's taking him for a walk and someone's out there making lunch, right, to send somebody home on the rotation. What's that?
To provide an alibi.
Yeah. Or that. Ira, did you want to add something else?
Well, the second part of the Rashi also would be an ethical lesson that he, you know, he's so concerned that he's going to cause grief to his father.
That he himself is grieving.
That he himself is trying to grieve.
Right. That's also a very astute observation.
I know, Sylvie? I was just going to say the same thing that he said, that, you know, he was so concerned about his father, it was his rotation, but, you know, and...
Yeah, there's a great irony there.
There's ironic, I mean, you know, this was his favorite child. I mean,
right.
When you play favorites, you're really opening up a hornet's
right.
nest.
Just incidentally, and without knowing the text by heart, if you go back and look at the text, and it's great for the, as we're talking about this coming Parsha, if you go back and look at the text, what do the brothers do right after they sell Yosef?
They sit down and have lunch.
Right? It's unbelievable. Right? There's a, and this Rashi sort of fits into that theme. They're operating really on two totally, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Mutually exclusive, totally discordant levels. You know, on the one hand, they're so concerned about this rotation, and they're so concerned about the flocks and their regular everyday routine, and at the same moment, almost, right, they're doing this kind of unthinkable act of selling their little brother into slavery. Marcia?
This is what they might talk about, people compartmentalizing their life.
Yeah. That's a great example. You know, it's how does someone, you know, you could have this guy who's a criminal on, you know, he does X, Y, and Z, but he's the biggest tzaddik when it comes to taking care of the old age home and his neighbor. You know, you have two totally discordant quotes.
We come across this perfect example. These people were perfect family people. They had loved their wives, they loved their husbands,
and yet... Meaning it's a totally different scale, but yeah, meaning it's not a bad analog.
Then, you know, I think it was Rabbi Yitzhak Greenberg said that the people who were the victims,
yeah,
at night they go to sleep and they say, how come I survived? And they didn't, my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, and yet the perpetrators could go to sleep and they sleep a good night's sleep because they fucking lost.
Right.
So that's essentially what the brothers were doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. So, as a just to close this this third point about Rashi's capacity to keep the text moving and to keep it interesting, have a look at source number 12. Avram Grossman actually makes a very nice observation, and Alan, actually coming back to your point, I mean Rashi compared to Ibn Ezra, Rashi compared to Rashbam, you know, people in his world, a century or so apart. Why is Rashi commentary so much more successful? So he says, you know, in source number 12, Perish Me'ein Zeh Shekasu Rabbeinu Avraham Ibn Ezra V'Rashbam. So he had other commentaries on a pshat level. He's talking about just the pshat of Rashi. He had other commentaries around in the next century in the same vein. He had the Ibn Ezra, he had Rashbam. He says, first of all, I want to just add a sub-point, says Avram Grossman, which is that those commentaries were really written to be appreciated by the real sophisticates, people who are real experts in grammar and diction. And you know, Hakorim b'Peirushim, Hayu b'Derech Klal Anashim Shenimnu Ima Alita HaChebratit VaIntellectualit. Says those was that was really geared to the elite intellectual, you know, intelligentsia of the generation, and not to the average reader. Hamoneam chifsu perush yashlim b'kitzara et hatmuna hamituaret b'mikra. Your average reader wants a commentary that's going to fill in the gaps and help us paint in the missing pieces of the picture of the text of the Torah. Yannick Omek Rad Yoter Mashmut Ludvarin Biashiret Olamam Ha Intellectuali Irgashi Shel Alamdim. Right, a commentary that's going to enrich the text and the meaning of the text to your average reader. He actually he asks his great rhetorical question. He says, "Ha'im ha'beirurim ha'ditukim ha'chashuvim." Is the great you know, very clear and precise grammatical interpretations, the hasodot, or the important grammatical, let's say, secrets. Shall Ibn Ezra dibru alibosh alibosh al Yehudi min hashura? Do those speak to the heart of your average Jew? He tells you it's, you know, it's a tzerei instead of a segel. Yeah, does that talk to the average reader? He says, "Ha'im pirushav ha'chashuvim shel Rashbam, or the Rashbam, al derech ha'pshat, yachlu limshoch korim rabim." Is that really going to be able to attract the attention of the masses? "Ha'im yesh b'perushim la'ashiv et nefesh ha'lomed ulchazek ulcham shel Yehudim." Is that going to inspire and really give energy and life to your average reader, shechipsu pashar v'tachlit l'sablutam begalut, especially to your average readers who are dealing with the challenges and oppressions of living in exile? Okay, he goes on to explain the difference between the Ramban and the other commentaries. But I think he makes this very astute observation, which is, you know, this point that we're making. Rashbam's commentary, the intention is not to give life to the text. The intention is not to give life to the reader. It's to help the really sophisticated reader better know the difference between one grammatical usage and another grammatical usage, a particular word choice here, a particular word choice there. Occasionally it touches on important themes or issues that will actually contribute to the value system that we're trying to promote, but that's not the goal. Part of Rashi's mission is really exactly this, to give an enriching sense of inspiration to the reader by making the text that much more alive and that much more readable. Concision and brevity as reason number one. Moral relevance as reason number two. I think we could add as reason number three, Rashi's capacity to bring the text to life. The fourth suggestion I'd like to make as to answer our original question of Rashi's staying power is one that I can't substantiate with any real evidence. Avram Grossman makes this argument as well. And I think, this is my own personal opinion, and you'll agree or disagree as you see fit, but I think it actually makes a lot of sense. Avram Grossman argues, he says, you can't dissociate the commentary of Rashi on the Torah from his commentary on the Talmud. The popularity of Rashi's commentary on the Talmud was so immense that it has to be factored into the popularity of his commentary on the Torah. Which is to say, in these centuries, you had a lot of, let's say, philosophical debate about what are the important principles, what are the important values. You know, we have these codifiers, the Rambam and the Rif and the Tor, and everyone is trying to boil down the Talmud and the core values of Judaism. Which is it? Is it this one? Is it that one? And they're blasting each other back and forth. Who's right? Who's wrong? They're burning each other's books. Rashi has had one acceptance as the preeminent Talmudic commentator. He did it. He mastered all of Shas, and he was accepted as the master of Shas. That being known makes it so much more understandable that if you're looking for guidance, if you're looking for a source, if you're looking for the authority, if you're looking for someone to invest with authority, who's it going to be? Who has the key to that Mesorah? Who has the key to that legacy? To the real deal? To the genuine article? Everyone's trying to push their agenda and to say, this is the real deal. This is the genuine article. So which is it? And the fact almost that there's so much debate about what that is almost encourages people to take a step back and say, well, Rashi... It's got Rashi has to. I mean, Rashi was the authority on the Talmud. So, if you want to talk about the Mesorah and you want to talk about our heritage and you want to talk about the real deal, it's got to be Rashi. So his commentary on the Torah, almost by definition, has to be right. Just a continuation of that same investment in this sense of an authority figure. Now, the problem is, it's not really knowable, or at least not known to me, which popularity came first. Was he known first and foremost as a great Talmudic commentator, or was he known first and foremost as a great commentator on the Torah, or did they happen kind of simultaneously? So I can't offer real evidence to support this argument, but I happen to think, just on a personal level, it makes a lot of sense. You buy it? You don't buy it? Any reactions?
Just the fact that he did so much, it was so amazingly productive.
Yeah, I mean, that almost had to lend weight. I mean, I'm trying to think of a secular analog. I don't have one off the top of my hat. But you have someone who just has a reputation for being so masterful and so prolific, it's almost like anything he's going to produce is going to be that masterful and that... Yeah, almost, that's not a bad example. It's like, it's Shakespeare, so it's got to be great.
So he thinks that one of his greatest abilities, and really it's a very simple one, is the famous word for kiss. Keep it simple, stupid, and that's what he did. He kept it simple, yeah. And he wasn't stupid, but he just, that was his philosophy.
Right.
I want man, the common man, and
right.
to understand exactly what the Torah has to say, because right. basically, we live and... abide by the Torah. That is how we are. We are our reason for living, our
right.
reason for our whole met way of living
right.
is developed from the Torah. Now, if you don't understand what the heck you're doing, how can you?
No, of course. And I think that's a great point, and it touches on the point Avram Grossman made in source number 12 and the first point that we brought up about Rashi's concision. We're running out of time, so I just want to hold off on the questions for a moment. If we have time, we'll come back to them, because I want to just share with you this fifth rationale, which, if you remember nothing else from this course, I hope you'll take this with you. To me, it's the single most meaningful part of anything we've done over the past 7 weeks. You could agree or disagree, but I would like to suggest to you that part of what makes Rashi so compelling, and I would even argue that it's what makes Rashi, it's the primary reason that makes Rashi so compelling, is very, very simply Rashi's unbounded love for Hashem, for the Torah, and for the Jewish people. And I would argue that it's all over Rashi's commentary. And if we had time, I would bring 100 examples. I want to share with you 4. Have a look at source number 14. We'll go through them very quickly, because immediately you'll start to see a pattern emerge. Source number 14. It's the first pasuk in Sefer Shmos. These are the names, the children of Israel who came from Egypt, Yaakov, and the children of his household. Rashi's commentary to that pasuk, source number 15. Ve'elu shmos b'nei Yisrael. Apa pi shemenan b'chayehem b'shmosan. Even though they were already counted, we knew the numbers already. You don't have to go back and recount them, which is about to be what happens in the forthcoming psukim. Chazar u'mina'an b'misasan. The Torah goes back and records them even after they've died. Lahodiyah chibasan shenim shalu l'kochavim. To tell you about God's love for the Jewish people who are compared to the stars. Shemotziyan u'machnisan b'mispar u'vishmosan. That he takes them out and brings them in and counts them by their names. Look at source number 16. Again, you'll start to see a pattern emerge. The very first pasuk of Sefer, Vayikra. Bottom of page 2. Vayikra Moshe v'yidaber Hashem l'ilav mi'ohel mo'ed le'mor. It's almost not worth commenting on that pasuk. It's so simple. Hashem called to Moshe and said to him, right from the tent of meeting, saying the following. Rashi, source 17, top of page 3. Vayikra Moshe. Of all the languages of speaking and saying and commanding, Kriya, the language of calling, is at the top because it is Lashon Chiba, because it's the language of love. Lashon Shemalachi Asharis Mishnam Shimbo. It's the language that the angels use when we talk about them and communicating in their own world. Shemar, the Kara Ze El Ze. Right? Because it's the language they use to call each other. It's the language reserved for love. It's in English almost the same thing, in a poetic language, you know, back to Shakespeare, I already put him in my mind. Right? He called to her. Right? She called to him as a language of affection, as a language of love. The very first pasuk of the next book of the Torah. Bamidbar, source number 18. Hashem Moshe b'Midbar Sinai on the way. Hashem spoke to Moshe in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting. On the first of the second month, the second year that they had left from Egypt. Source number 19. Rashi to that pasuk. Vayidaber b'Midbar Sinai b'Echad l'Chodesh. Mitoch chibasan lefanav. Mone osam kolsha. Because of God's great love for the Jewish people, He counts them all the time. Counted them when they left Egypt. Counted them again after the sin of the golden calf to know how many were left. When he comes to bring the Mishkan, he counts them again. He counts them over and over again to demonstrate his love for the Jewish people. And finally, sources number 20 and 21. This is the beginning of Sefer Devarim. Like, these are the words that Hashem said to Moshe. I'm sorry, that Moshe said to the Jewish people in Transjordan, in the desert. Mul suf bein parana bein tokel levalvan chatzeros v'dizahav. The Torah goes on to give all these cryptic place names. Eile hadvarim. These are the words lefisha hen divrei tochachos, because these are harsh words and words of criticism. Mana kan kol mekomas shechisu lefni hamakom behen. The Torah goes on to list all the places where God had been angry with the Jewish people. So as not to hurt the feelings of the Jewish people. So as not to make them sad. So as not to make them uncomfortable. The Torah hides the place names because they would be too painful to remember and to acknowledge them. So it only hints to them out of respect, out of kavod for Bnei Yisrael. It's the opening of Shmos, of Vayikra, of Bamidbar, of Dvarim, and without getting into all the details, Sefer Bereishis doesn't open with this exact formula for a different reason, but is really about the love for the land of Israel. Throughout his commentary on the five books of the Torah, and really throughout his commentary on Tanakh, and we could explain countless themes in Rashi with this notion. There's this unbounded love for Hashem and for the Jewish people and for the Torah, and the hope that Rashi in this outpouring of these types of comments will imbue the reader with the same love and the same devotion for the Torah, for the mitzvot, for Hashem, and for the Jewish people. Think for a moment of how Rashi always sides with the Avos. In the eyes of Rashi, the Avos can never do anything wrong. You know, something appears to be Yaakov deceives his father. No, Yaakov had Ruach HaKodesh, he knew. There's always some, what appears, right, to the contemporary or, you know, sensibilities of the modern reader, oh, it's Rashi whitewashing this terrible sin of the Avos. And other commentaries will come and say, you know, the Ramban will say, oh, that was a sin, he shouldn't have done it. And that seems like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. Why didn't Rashi say that? It's almost as if Rashi couldn't say that. It's almost as if that would have been a violation of Rashi's own sense of consciousness. Because Rashi just wants you to love the others. Rashi just wants you to love the patriarchs and the matriarchs and the characters in the Torah. And if the Torah is telling you about them and they did X or Y or Z, and you might suspect that it's something problematic and that might cause you to like them a little less, Rashi comes and says, no, I'll explain it to you. I'll explain why that wasn't such a problem. I want you to love Avraham. I want you to love Yitzchak. I want you to love Yaakov. I want you to love the Torah. I want you to live every mitzvah. And it's such a pervasive theme in Rashi. Again, I don't think you'll find anyone who writes this among contemporary commentaries on Rashi. It's my own thought, and you're welcome to take it or to leave it. But I firmly believe that this is one of the most compelling answers to our initial question. Why has Rashi survived, and why has Rashi thrived throughout all these years? Because he speaks at a level which touches the most basic human emotion, and that is our capacity and our need to love Hashem, to love the Torah, to love one another, to love every other human being. And it's so pervasive, it's so almost subconscious in the commentaries of Rashi throughout Tanakh that you can't help but embrace it. It's like a guy who has a personality where you can't exactly pinpoint it, but you just want to be on his team because he always says the right thing and he always has the right joke and he always has the right smile and he's so charismatic and energetic. Everyone wants to be his friend. So why is that? Because you get the sense that he loves you and he loves other people and he's so real and so genuine and just wants to make that love a part of everything. So it just creates this natural this natural attraction. In my own mind, I believe that that is the single most compelling reason why Rashi has had so much staying power over the last 1,000 years. I think it's all five. I think it's about his concision and his readability. I think it's about his ongoing moral relevance. I think it's about his ability to bring the text alive and inspire the reader. I think it has to do with his connection as historically a master of the Talmud, which then translated into his acceptance as an authority figure on the Torah. And I think it's about Rashi's love for Hashem, for the Torah, and for the Jewish people. With that, I will conclude. Happy, of course, to entertain questions either now. I think we're just about out of time, but we can certainly pick up with any lingering questions next time, and then we'll have a special class next week at 7 o'clock on Hanukkah. I think we called it celebrating Hanukkah with Rashi. Take one last question for Manny, and then we will call it a wrap.
I just wanted to point out point to the point you're making. And that's what Grossman mentions toward the end.
Yeah.
That Rashi wanted to console the Jewish people in the Galut.
Yeah.
And give them purpose and give them a sense of what it's all about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what better way to console someone other than by putting your arm around their shoulder and saying,
there's a connection between the last point and the second point. The last point is protecting the image of the Avod, because in the second point he sees the Torah as having a moral and ethical message. So
absolutely.
The way you reinforce that message.
Absolutely. 100%. So I look forward to seeing you all next week for our special Hanukkah class.
Next semester.
Next semester, I think we're going to be...